I started off on a good footing. And then I'll have you introduce yourself and your connection to the grain industry and say whatever you like.
Okay.
Okay? Ready to go.
Does that look like it's right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, that's good. So see, it's not going beyond. So introducing a session with Mr. Richard Croft at his business office on Berry Street in Winnipeg on October 22nd, 2009. And we'll start the session just by asking Mr. Croft to introduce himself and tell us a bit about his connection to the grain industry.
Okay, well, thank you for coming. My connection to the grain industry was by inheritance, really. My father, Charles Croft, best known as Charlie Croft, spent his life in the grain industry, and it's really his story that has fascinated me about the industry. I grew up in Winnipeg. He lived his life after coming as an immigrant when he was age 6 in Winnipeg. Our whole family life has been here. I did my university undergraduate degree in Winnipeg and a law degree. And in 1963, I joined the company that my father, of which my father was president, which was McCabe Grain Company. And went into that business as in-house counsel and general administrative person on all sorts of things, and began to learn the business of the grain trade, and got involved in all parts of the business, whether it was development of property for the feed industry or the seed business or overseas trading, and I was just generally introduced to the business from the period of 1963 to 1967, which was my main time there. I had worked in the company in my school days before that, working on trucks or in a feed mill or in the office on summer breaks during university. But so that started in 56. So the period, really, the decade from 56 to about 66 was the time that I was close at hand. But of course, having grown up with it, there was really never a time that I didn't feel part of the grain industry. In the time that I was with McCabe, I spent some time away. My wife and I went to London in 63, 64. We had an office in London. McCabe had an office in London, which was a partnership of a British grain trader and South African interests, and the McCabe Company had a trading office in London, and I spent a year in London working in the office there and training in a merchant bank in London, learning about international trade. So my education was sort of kept on going. And then in 67, I took a leave from McCabe to go to work in Ottawa. Mitchell Sharp was then the Minister of Finance, and he was an old Winnipegger and had been very involved with the grain industry. He had started out with Richardson's, and then during the war went to Ottawa as part of the wartime administration and really never came back, and he was responsible as minister for the Canadian Wheat Board, and he was deputy minister of trade and then minister of trade, so he had a deep connection with the business of the grain industry, and he invited me to go to Ottawa on his staff in the winter of 66, so in 67 my wife and I moved to Ottawa, and we spent 2.5 years there. I was his special assistant and then his chief of staff or executive assistant when he moved from finance to what we then called external affairs under the Trudeau government. So in the period that I was working in Ottawa, McCabe was sold. So I was on a leave of absence from a company that by the time I finished my term didn't exist anymore. So I went off to other things. But I'll just mention what happened in that period with the selling. It was sold in two parts. The line elevator business was sold to United Grain Growers, and that was a transaction arranged between my father and Mac Runciman, a great figure in the Canadian grain industry, who was then president of United Grain Growers. And the line elevators were sold to UGG, and then in 68, the balance of the business, which was the feed part and the seed processing and the terminal elevator in the Lakehead and the marketing and international trade portion, was sold to National Grain, which was Canadian arm of the Heffelfinger family out of Minneapolis, PV companies out of Minneapolis. They operated as National Grain in Canada, and National bought McCabe, and then I recall 3 or 4 or 5 years later, maybe 1974, Cargill bought National. So it was the fish eating the littler one and the littler one. But my direct involvement ended really when I went to Ottawa and as the company unwound. But I've been fascinated with the industry my whole life, and in the process, because of working in it, or because of my father, and because of work I did in Ottawa, I've kind of seen it from different angles. So I'm happy with the opportunity to talk to you about it. Mm-hmm.
After the company was sold from under you.
Mm-hmm. Good way to put it.
Did your other careers ever sort of draw upon your...
Well, actually, it's interesting that you ask the question that way. while I was involved with McCabe in 1964, a couple of fellows came to visit me. One of my jobs was to look at other related or extended business opportunities, because in the grain business we were always looking for new ways to apply what we knew. And I had a visit from a couple of fellows who thought they had a new idea for agricultural research. And they had been in the commercial refrigeration business, working for a company called Fleming Peddler or Coldstream. Those were two companies owned by a guy by the name of Charlie Fleming in Winnipeg. And they made coolers for the food industry and that sort of thing. But the two people who came to see me said, you know, there's a new, based on what we know, there's a whole new business opportunity for making rooms and chambers, which are really small rooms, things like the refrigerator, for researchers to use in growing seeds and other type of agricultural research, and controlling the temperature and humidity and other elements having to do with growing. And because you know all about the grain business, you're a natural investor in this. Well, I was 26 and sort of very wise and experienced, and but it was interesting, and it was one step before a startup. They had never sold anything. They had made a couple of test products, and they were operating basically in a garage. So, but we kind of got intrigued, and I said, let me try to do something with this. So we invested some money, and in return for that, as long as we were owed money, the arrangement was that we could control the business. So I went about putting that business together, found space and found some people, and figure out how to do the accounts and engineering and all this. And we set up a company to produce these products for agricultural research, growth environmental rooms and growth chambers. And got that started, and then I went off. I helped do that, and then I took a leave from that too while I was in Ottawa, and somebody else kind of oversaw. But when I came back a couple of years later, I got very much back involved. That was one of the things, because I, what I did was, after the grain business had sold, there was some non-related businesses that were not part of what was sold, and I came back to take hold of those, because my father and most of his associates were retiring or going on to other things. And that business then that I had started, called Controlled Environments, which we now call Conviron, is where we sit today. And 45 years later, we have product in 80-odd countries, and we are the leading company in the world in making this kind of product for agricultural research, and now into biotech and all other kinds of things. So that was a grain story starting, and it's gone on to many other things since. But so I did that until built and worked at this business, and then I was starting to think of what I would do to. I was into my getting around 60, and I figured I didn't want to work at this forever. What do I do? And always, what happens in business, people, you know, or get interested in your company and have all sorts of ideas for you. But one day, I have three children, two boys and a girl. One of them lives in Winnipeg still, and he was a lawyer, practicing, a very good litigator in Winnipeg. And one got talking, and he decided, said he didn't really want to be a lawyer the rest of his life, even though he was doing fine at it. And I said, well, I'm kind of busy trying to figure out what to do here. Why don't you come and spend some time with me? And there was some things that we didn't have internal capacity for, intellectual property issues and international agreements, things that he could immediately get his hands on. So he came in here in March of 97 at the age of 30. And in May of 98, 15 months later, I got a phone call from John Chrétien asking if I wanted to go to the Senate. And that was a Thursday, and the following Monday, I was sitting in my seat in the Senate. So things happened pretty fast, and a lot of meetings over the summer, and with management and directors and everybody. And lo and behold, by September 1st, Steve was, having arrived a year and a half earlier, was CEO of this company. And so for the last 10 years, he's been building this business. And when I went to Ottawa to the Senate and chose not to stay to my full age 75 term, but when I retired from the Senate, I came back here and returned to the board of Conviron, and I'm chairman of the company, but I didn't go back into any operating role, which is fine with me and fine with them. And so that's sort of the Conviron story, and I do seem to find other things to do.
When you were talking about the Senate, a question popped into my mind about sort of the agricultural issues come and go. Were there agricultural issues during your time in the Senate?
Oh, yeah. I never served on the agricultural committee in the Senate, but the Senate being what it is, everybody is involved in everything. I chaired a committee called Internal Economy, which is the committee that sort of runs the administration of the Senate, and I chaired the Senate Banking, Trade, and Commerce Committee, which was the last thing I did before I left. But agricultural issues were never far from us, and the way our caucuses worked, as each party caucuses on a regional basis and on a national basis. So there was a Western Liberal caucus, and so every week I would be facing directly issues in Western Canada, which were most often or very often agricultural issues. And in that period, we had enormous swings in the viability of farms, pricing issues, and the need for support of the grain industry at that time, because there was some very dramatic swings in pricing. And of course, we had issues of cattle and disease problems that absolutely ravaged the cattle industry. So, yeah, very close to all these things. And of course, I brought a real interest in it, and I was never far from from keeping on top of those issues. And good friends of mine were in the government and in Parliament, were very directly engaged, so I was able to keep pretty well informed. But it wasn't my particular interest while I was there. But it's a great place to sort of keep your eye on everything that's happening.
Anyway. I guess. So I'm going to go way back.
Okay.
Again. You were talking about your dad coming over when he was very young. Where did he come from, and why did he come?
Well, he
can't add here.
There's nothing unique in his story, and I really find his story to be quite a remarkable thing. And I have my own attempts at recording it, so we do that, but it's a person. I mean, it's really the personal side of the story. His family was one of the many, many, many that came from Russia in the early part of the 20th century. They came here, and Dad was born in Russia in 1906 and came here in 1912. As near as we can figure. Little tricky to pin down, because I got a cousin who has another date and another cousin who figures another date. But anyway, by 1912, his parents and brothers and sisters who were then born, there was one more born after they got here. And it was a tough time. By the time he was 12 or so, he had one or two jobs. And when he was 17, he dropped out of high school after grade 10, I guess, because he was the oldest and the family needed to be supported. So he had sold papers near Portage in Maine in the mornings for a time, and I think he became, looked up with the grain exchange building and sort of saw the world go by. And as a young kid, he very early became fascinated with the trade and the people, and he had a great interest in geography, and the idea of things going out all over the world from here caught his fancy at a very early stage. So when he went to work when he was 17, he trotted off to the grain exchange and somehow found himself a job as an office boy to a grain company then called McLean and Company, I think. Now, whether it was him or the Times, but within the first year that he was there, that company went bankrupt. So he claims he wasn't responsible. It was taken over or absorbed by what was called McCabe Brothers Grain Company. So that's how he entered McCabe as an asset of the McLean takeover, as an office boy, so McCabe was where he began in 23, and I got that right. He was born in about 1923, and that's where he had his entire career and life. McCabe is an interesting story, and not unlike a number of other of the companies. The McCabe family were originally from Duluth, Minnesota. They were general merchants in the Duluth area. Excuse me, going back into the... Well, I don't know how far back. I've got some knowledge of them back into the 1880s and 90s, and they were a major family there. And like many sort of general merchants, they would take grain in payment and began to trade, and then they'd have to build storage for this grain that they took in, and very quickly found themselves as grain dealers. They would be trading in these products. Somewhere in the early part of the 20th century, they moved the base of their operations to Minneapolis, and that's where they were based. And built a substantial grain business in the northwestern U.S. as McCabe Brothers Grain Company. In 1913, they first opened an office, first began to operate up into Canada. And the story, as I understand it, and again, probably not unique amongst other families who were grain trading families in the Minneapolis area, they followed the railway. So James Hill, who had developed the Great Northern Railway, wanted to come up into Canada and create traffic on a rail line up to Brandon. And the story that I grew up understanding from the McCabe family, that as I knew them, because there was still parts of that family in time of my memory, there was a friendship or a relationship between Hill out of Minneapolis and the McCabes, and he said, well, I want to build a grain line, and why don't you build elevators, because I need something to put on my rail cars. So they moved up, and the Winnipeg Grain Exchange, of course, was an active place by then. So McCabe sent somebody up to Winnipeg to open an office here, and they began to build some facilities on the line. A man by the name of Carl Austin came here in, I think, 1913, and established the McCabe Brothers Grain Company in Winnipeg, and began to build a Canadian grain company. It was owned by the McCabe family, but that's what he did, and there were others doing the same thing at the same time. And Carl Austin was a very talented and far-seeing man, and he obviously did a good job of starting to build this business, of course. And one of the very right things he did was spot my father as a young kid around the business, and they developed a relationship that was really for 40 years that lasted. And I find it hard to kind of picture now. I find it actually quite exciting. But Dad was 17 when he went in there as an office boy, and when he was 20, they bought him a trading position on the floor of the grain exchange. He couldn't actually use it till he was 21, because the rule was you had to be 21. So for this kid who had come here when he was 6, 15 years later, he was training for an international company on the Winnipeg Grain Exchange, and a pretty good pace. And he grew up with the company, and my mother were married in 33, so he would have been all about 31 by then, and they built the business just the way the Searles and the Sellers and everybody else were building their companies, and they were starting to get more interested in export and European relationships. But then, of course, the war intervened. But in 38, a fellow by the name of Walter Reef from London, he and his father had a grain a trading agency in London. They were originally from Austria. Came looking for supply people that they could represent in the market, you know, agricultural products in Europe. And Walter came here in the fall of 38, an auspicious time. I had I had just arrived, but they started to plan. The idea was that they would build some connections for trading, and the war just stopped pretty much everything for the next few years. But not long after the war, they were in touch through that time, and I honestly don't know what, if any, business went on, but shortly after the war, they were then getting very active in international trade. So that the office in London, Walters Fern Schwartz and Company was the name of it, associated itself with McCabe and with company out of South Africa, very large integrated agricultural company called Tiger Oats and Milling, and owned by a family by the name of Frankel, who continue to be generations of friends of ours. And this was globalization. This was taken off at an early stage. We had this South African company and the whole range of products from all the grains to fish meal to the protein grains and everything from here. And London became the hub of all this trading. So Schwartz and Company in London was the arm of both the South African and the Canadian companies. And my father became a regular. I mean, he became a part of the grain industry scene in London and in Europe, and because they built their relationships. They sold to millers and traders and various people all over Europe, and those people started to send their next generation over to here for training. So we always had somebody living in or around the house and in the office from Germany or from France or from South Africa or London or whatever. And that's the house I grew up in. You never know who was at the table or what the language was, because we were in what was, I guess, really the first great international business out of this area. Many of us do it now, but the people in the grain business were really unique in that.
So your dad traveled a lot then?
He traveled a lot. He did. He was in Europe two or three times every year in those years, and a lot of back and forth. I made my first trip over there in 57, just a student trip for the summer, but in 63 we were living there and working in the office there.
Was that the same company? Were you working for that company then?
Same company.
At the time,
yeah.
Okay.
Same company. But then I'll just jump, because you asked a question about Conviron, and did I use any of relate to any of my grain connections, and the answer is yes, very much, in all sorts of ways. When we, as we started to develop Conviron, you need all the things that a business needs, and the first thing we needed was some knowledge as to, if you're selling something to somebody somewhere else, you need to know about foreign exchange and letters of credit. And so where did I go? I went trotting over to the guys I knew in the business in the grain exchange, and we just drew on that experience, because that was enormous expertise that this company brought. And that's something that really is probably not appreciated, is the fact that somebody can be dealing in grain and I can be dealing in growth chambers and somebody else can be dealing in tractors, but the fundamental pieces of how you carry on those transactions, the knowledge of foreign exchange and the letters of credit and bonding and all this, is exactly the same no matter what the product is. So my learning experience out of the grain business was very, very valuable in terms of taking this company, a local business, into an export business, because our product is so narrow and specialized, there's not a big enough market in Canada to build it. And in addition to that, then go back, you asked about dad's traveling and who we sold to. Out of the grain business, we had people who had been distributors or agents or some kind or another that product was sold through. So I went trotting over there and finding these people and saying, either do you want to become an agent for something, for an agricultural research product, or who do you know that might? And it was absolutely through the use of those relationships that I had a real head start in being able to both understand what I was doing and has some contacts. So, but the time that I jump around a little here, if you don't mind, but it when you look back on it, there were a few things that about McCabe that were quite, you know, I find quite particularly interesting. One is that when they, right after the war in 1946, as a matter of fact, I was trying to pin down the date, the Canadian company had become more distinctly a Canadian and global company, and the American company, their interests were separating a bit in that U.S. company was sort of, I won't say winding down, but didn't have the same interest in growth and pursuing the diversification that came through Canada and the capital support that came with that. So in 1946, Carl Austin, who was then just about, that's the guy who came here in 1913, was just about at the end of his career. My father was effectively running the company then. He didn't have the title of president, but he was effectively running. They did what in today's parlance would be called a leverage buyout, an LBO, and they went to the Toronto financial markets and did a equity, a stock and bond issue, raised money on the, became a public company, raised money on the Toronto Stock Exchange to buy themselves from the Canadian parent. I suspect they were the first Canadian grain company to do that. I don't know. You know, the Richardsons always had their Canadian roots and have always been private. the Sellers and Federal Grain and Searle and the Leeches and all those went different directions, and of course the co-ops were always Canadian. But the McCabe story, in terms of an American company that bought its, like the Canadian child then bought itself and became a public company, publicly traded company, because there are not that many publicly traded grain companies in Canada altogether. Now, of course, I mean, my father would be astonished to find that the old mortal enemies, the co-ops and all these people are just another public entity trading on the stock exchange. But in those days, so I'm sure they were the first, and I don't know who else actually became a public company in that way, but it was a very creative thing to do, a very imaginative thing to do. And it allowed them to raise the capital they needed to sort of get into this post-war growth period. I mean, the terminals, you know, Thunder Bay needed work, the line elevators, what used to be a line elevator of small scale was suddenly having to become larger, and we grew quite a bit, in quite extensively, in the feed manufacturing business. So feed plants were built in Winnipeg and Brandon and Moose Jaw and Edmonton and Brooks. And that all required capital, and this was done by going to public markets. But even then, scale was the enemy. And by the mid-60s, my father was, you know, then later in his career, he was still a relatively young man, but the team that he had built the business with, the company needed to go into this next round. I mean, the inland terminals that were being built were enormous, and the work at the lakehead was in St. Prince Rupert, and the world was just changing. And McCabe, with I guess about 120 line elevators through to the Port Arthur, sorry, Port Arthur, the Thunder Bay, that really dates me to the terminal, was just not big enough. So the decision had to be made, and the management group sort of decided that they had their run, and to start over on this was a big challenge. So that's when they made the decision to sell the line elevators, and then the balance of the business, as I described earlier, which happened in the 60s. So my timing of entering the grain business in the early 60s was a wonderful experience, but it wasn't propitious in terms of that opportunity.
When we had talked earlier, mm-hmm. a phrase that you had said stuck in my mind, and at least I believe you said it, and it was in relation to when your dad, you know, decided that the next round was mm-hmm. for somebody else. And I think you said, he said the industry wasn't as much fun anymore.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, I might have said that. I certainly, if I would observe it, I mean, I was probably sitting up. I mean, it wasn't as much fun in that when everybody was smaller and nimble, and the trick was to, the emphasis was on trading, the emphasis was on being there fast and seeing the next idea and finding the next market and getting into the Russian market or the Chinese market ahead of the other guy. It was that intellectual exercise, and he dearly loved that, and he was wonderful at it. He was just a fantastic guy. But when it became a battle of balance sheets, when your ability to take your position meant building massive facilities in Prince Rupert or at Thunder Bay or inland terminals or whatever, and just the capital that it required to do crushing plants and the oil seeds, and everything was happening explosively. It was a different kind of it was an industrial game rather than a trading business. And so if I said it would have been in that context, the thing that had excited him about the business was not that it wasn't still there, but it just wasn't possible to do it from the scale that they had. And he was, by then he was in his early 60s. And he stayed on, actually, after the sale of to National in 68. He stayed on as chairman of the board of National and saw that into the Cargill acquisition. And then at 65 ran into Cargill's carved in stone retirement policy. So he just found another way into the, so he was into mid-70s, he was still engaged in the mid-1970s, still engaged through the, as he followed the company into its new forms. But
did he stay active in the exchange?
Yeah, he was always around the exchange. He did a one-man commission or study for the federal government on futures trading that they had some issues with. He was on the board of CN for CN Rail because his knowledge of the Canadian rail industry was massive. He went on to the board of CN in the early 70s. He died in 84. He was on the board of CN until a year or two before he died. And then, interestingly, 8 or 9 years later, I went onto the board of CN and had a great time there. And we took it from being a crown corporation to being a public company in those years. So that was just a sheer coincidence, but it was great fun to go back there. So he kept his he was only 78 when he died, but he kept his grain roots and his grain understanding actively employed really right through his whole life. And And there were some other historical things in a more personal note that its importance to you or how interested somebody is will depend on their perspective. But my dad was a young Jewish immigrant coming into Winnipeg, and the culture and environment of the Winnipeg Grain Exchange was not a natural habitat for young Jewish people at that time. And there were a handful around the Grain Exchange, some great people. There was Charlie Schwartz, and there was the Ripstein family. But they generally operated as brokers, you know, on independent brokers. Charlie, through Northern Sales, developed a fairly active company. And Joe Dreeman, who was a marvelous grain trader for his whole life. But Dad went into this this American-owned company as a kid, and came right up through that business and ended up running it completely, which was a very unusual thing to happen at that time. And it was sort of capped by the fact that in 1952 he became chairman of the Board of Governors of the Winnipeg Grain Exchange, which was really, in the eyes of those who understood the history and culture of the institution, it was quite a remarkable thing. He had been on the board for some years before that, but he became chairman, and actually it was the same year that Sam Friedman went onto the bench and became the first Jewish member of the Manitoba Judiciary. So it was an indication that things were changing very, very rapidly. He had wonderful support from some of the families in the exchange, who all recognized that it was a new world coming, and it was a world of merit, and that's how you proceeded. So he had a fabulous career, and so it's really because my fascination with the industry, it'll be clear to you, is really because of my interest in his story and the way it came through. But there are other family stories. I mean, the Leach and Searle families have been lifelong friends of ours, and Searle Grain was one of the great companies, and then they put that together with the sellers of Federal Grain, and the Smiths and the Murphys, and you know, all the others. It was an amazing place. And the Grain Exchange, when I started first working in there, I guess the first summer I worked in there would have been in the mid-50s, 58, the first time I worked in the Grain Exchange. It was a very special place. I mean, there was great action and great vitality, and of course the floors, trading floors, were still trading floors, and there were open pit, you know, there were auction markets, and you were in there with your live bid, and I was trained in all that stuff, and it was a very, very exciting place, and it was no wonder why so many bright young people looking for a career over through the 20s and the 30s had come there and seen that, wow, this is real action, you know, this is really something. Then the exchange left the auction bid, everything became electronic, and it's just not it's boring, but obviously it's fascinating, and computerized trading and all the other things to those people who are engaged in them are just as exciting and just as wonderful and just as dazzling as the other was. But that's the way history is. It's got to move on. But
if you had to think about your dad again in relation to, I think you've said a lot about what he liked about mm-hmm. the industry. What didn't he like about the industry?
You know, I don't think there's much that he didn't like about me.
Nothing that annoyed him?
Oh, yeah. No. There were things that annoyed him. there was a huge evolution with the co-ops, with the pools. And the Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta pool were seen by the private trade. Of course, they all worked together and competed together, but there was a long time when an enormous amount of energy was addressed to government policy to what was perceived as the pools operating at a tax advantage to the private trade because they were cooperatives and they didn't pay taxes in the same way. They saw it for a different way. But that was one of the grand policy debates. But there wasn't, in terms of what he didn't like about the business, I can't ever remember him complaining about very much. And there were some very exciting times. I mean, one of the most amazing things, he was closely involved when they were looking for more cash crop, more tradable crops on the exchange, and the whole evolution of rapeseed to canola. And he was involved with the Rosner Chair at the university in the funding of the research that was able to get the acids out of the old rapeseed and move it from a product that was basically producing oil products for industrial uses and converting it over to a food product. That happened relatively quickly. I mean, rapeseed had been around. I mean, it was an ancient biblical crop, but the emergence of canola as a food product and as a trading product was a massive thing. I mean, I don't know what the relative numbers are this particular crop year, but canola is a huge crop in world trade and canola oil and the whole thing. And that just didn't, that was created because a handful of people said, we need some research here to make this thing into another kind of a product. And it just transformed Western Canada. It was an amazing thing. So, you know, those were triumphant things. Anybody alone thinks there's canola, there's always been canola, but in my lifetime there wasn't, and then there was, and suddenly it was, and they knew exactly what they were doing. They said, here's a potential, it needs first funding, then research, then get it recognized as a market, and then go out and find, you know, and find market for it. And today you go to Hong Kong, every restaurant's cooking with canola oil. It's just amazing what happened. But I don't think there was much he didn't like about the business. He would have liked to, you know, do more. And I think if the competitive nature in him would have liked to get bigger rather than take it the way it did. But that was the way it went, and he was never sort of, it was just the time.
What about, was he politically involved in the small p way as far as...
You could not be when you were in the grain trade because there were so many policy issues that came into play. whether it was, first of all, if you were... In the grand scale, if you were in the early days of trading into Russia and China and wherever you were immersed in the political issues of the day, wherever you were. I remember his, into Eastern Europe and the trading into East Germany and all, very often the business precedes diplomacy very often because that's how the the walls come down off.
Break the ice.
Because of business first. So on that scale, they were never, you know, the trade was never far from the diplomats in terms of what they could do. But in the more sort of based domestic or day-to-day kind of things, lots of policy issues, as I say, tax issues and, you know, the development of the St. Lawrence Seaway. I mean, a huge thing at all, you know, the private trade, the shippers played enormous roles in creating the impetus. So there was having, and mainly a federal government, but having Ottawa know about, you know, the commitment of policies and the commitment of funds to things that were going to expand the trade meant that you just had to know who was in Ottawa and what the policy issues were. And I said, I worked for Mitchell Sharp. I mean, Mitchell grew up in the grain trade here, and as long as he lived, I mean, I was in the Senate, and he was across the street as a dollar-a-year man with Jean Chrétien when he was 93, and he was still figuring out, you know, what can we do on grain and policy issues. I worked with him during the 68 election, during Trudeau's election, and with the people from Bob Esdale, who was, I don't think he was in agriculture, I think he was in trade and commerce. And out of that came what's called the Canadian Grains Council, which is the forum when all the different players. Well, that policy was emerged then, but there is just the grain trade. It's like the lumber business. I mean, you can't be in that business without working constantly with those people who are negotiating border, you know, tariff issues or shipping issues or whatever. So they had to be very knowledgeable about what was going on. So in that political way, he was never particularly political in the big P way, except interestingly enough, toward the end of his career, he got quite active on behalf of the Liberal Party, and actually he was spent a period of time as the senior fundraiser for the Liberal Party here after he had retired. He just sort of got interested in it, but he was never in partisan political terms terribly. He had a sort of a philosophic bent, which I've never quite figured out what it was, because every time I tried to categorize him one way, there would be something the other way. I would think, gee, you know, you're being conservative. And then one day he said to me, I mean, he would have been 75, he said, you know, don't you think they should loosen up on the terms of decriminalization of marijuana? I don't know where that came from, but it just didn't seem to him right that all these young people were ending up with criminal records and all this kind of stuff. So I never quite figured him out in that regard. But and he was a tremendously active person in the community. And as he, you know, the early years, I guess, were nothing but work. I mean, he was traveling constantly. But as he moved into a more senior executive position, he did. Oh, he was years as a trustee of the pension fund for the city of Winnipeg, on the sinking fund trustee. He was on the Winnipeg Foundation. He was the executive of the Bombers, and he was president of the Canadian Club, and he was on the board of the Winnipeg Enterprises and the Arena. I don't know, he just seemed to find time to do all that because he was passionate about Winnipeg and Manitoba.
Did any of you have
I have one brother.
One brother. Did he become involved at all in
No. Nope. He nope. He like I followed him into law, and he practiced law. He became involved to the extent that he did work for the company, and because he was with Thompson Dorfman, with that firm, and Don Thompson, the senior in there, was the lawyer for McCabe and for a number of different interests in the grain business. So he professionally did some work, but no, he never became involved. And then he went onto the bench at quite a young age. But again, I was articled as a law student to Isaac Bibledo, and Isaac Bibledo was then the oldest practicing lawyer in the British Commonwealth when I began. He was 91 when I started, and he was still acting for the Northwest Line Elevators and going to Ottawa and presenting on freight rate hearings and things like that. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. So I figured, another thing about this business, it keeps you young and keeps you vital. And Isaac Bibledo was there when I got my call to the bar 4 years later. I articled all that period, and he lived to 97. You know, he had been born 3 months before Confederation, so that was kind of an interesting thing. But one way or another, I mean, if you were practicing law in this city, one way or another, you touched the grain trade, whether on transportation issues or government issues or whatever. I mean, it was just so central to the city as heart. People don't really understand today in the same way what the grain trade was in the city. I mean, it was really the center of where everything happened. And even the things that spun out, like the insurance companies and everything, kind of, if you go to their roots or where the capital was or where the families were that did these things, so much of it came out of the grain trade. I mean, you've got amazing family. I mean, you've got the Pattersons supporting you. An amazing story. I mean, whether I look as a senator and the story of Senator Patterson and that phenomenal career, and can't grow up in Thunder Bay without the Pattersons being a pretty important factor. Mm-hmm. So
that sort of leads me to shifting gears a little bit, mm-hmm. because one of the questions we have is and you've touched upon it a little bit, so you may not have much more to say, the historical connections of your family business, both you and your dad's time, with the port of Thunder Bay.
Well, of course, you couldn't be in the business without something every day having to do with Thunder Bay. I remember what I got to know it best was one of my assignments when I was in there. What year it was? Whether it was 64 or 65 or something. There had been a province of Ontario regulation, or I don't know if it came out of the labor code or elsewhere, but had to do with safety in the terminals. And up until then, everything had been open cage. The electric motors that drive the legs that move the grain were open cage type motors. And some of them had been up there for 50, 60 years. I mean, an electric engine will run, you know, forever and ever. But regulations required that it had to go to a whole new closed type engine because of the heat of the sparking and the combustion and the terrible danger of explosion and fire in the terminal. And so I was directly engaged in, on behalf of McCabe, in getting through that, and that meant the financing of the changing over of all these motors and the dealing with the authorities in Thunder Bay and the provincial authorities and making sure that there were compliance. And Sid Halter of C.D. Howe Engineering was our major electrical consultant on that, as he was for much of the industry. So that was a time when I was sort of almost living in and out of there for a while we got that job done. But, and you know, that I mentioned C.D. Howe, I mean, there's another, you know, fabulous story. I mean, the way that he built, his company built so much of the infrastructure.
Did your dad know him personally?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And we had a guy, an engineer. Well, he came out of the Norwegian apprentice system. He was never a graduate engineer, by the name of Ruben Seeblum. And Ruben had worked as a, I guess he had come over as an immigrant and worked as a carpenter, but by the time I remember, Ruben had become the guy who was responsible for building all the McCabe elevator. Build an elevator, he would run the team that we didn't use outside. He knew everything there was, or rebuilding or repairing or moving or anything. And when I don't remember this personally, but my father used to tell me that when during the war there was a rapid buildup of storage capacity at Thunder Bay, and designs were being done as to how to fast track these buildings and the storage, and Reuben had a way that he thought they should be built, and Dad went with Reuben's judgment. We're getting all sorts of contrary, and they ended up with the best dry grain count, the lowest loss of moisture and anything of any of the construction done in that period. So we always had sort of a one-up against the professional engineers on that. But Thunder Bay was a terrific, but as I slipped before, I mean, it was, you know, it was Fort William and Port Arthur for a long time. As I knew, and it's just absolutely of no direct consequence. But I today sit on the board of Wellington West Financial, which is Charlie Spiering, the company that Charlie Spiering has built. And a colleague of mine on the board is a woman from White Rock in BC, by the name of Nancy Schufelt, who is C.D. Howe's niece, her granddaughter. Sitting talking one day about something, and I can't remember what went. Oh, that's my grandfather. Amazing. So the world just gets smaller. But, you know, I can't pretend to have any sort of expertise about Thunder Bay. It's just that I grew up knowing where it was, what it did, and if it had a problem, if it had a strike, if it had a ice issue, if it had whatever it was, I knew what it was, and I have a very good friend here by the name of Richard Anderson, who recently sold but built up a company called Powell Equipment, which was the Caterpillar distributor for Northwestern Ontario and Manitoba, and that began in Thunder Bay. His grandfather was a Powell, and that was the third agency for Caterpillar tractors in the world. The third distributor in the world for Caterpillar tractors was in Thunder Bay, so there's a long history of that. But it seems so long ago now. I don't know.
Do you remember your first visit to the terminal elevator?
Well, I'm just going to let that go. I can't sort of tell you when, you know, what day it was or when it was, but I remember it because I equate it really with a trip I made with a family trip we made to Egypt in 1981. And the first time I saw the pyramids, you know, and I was taken aback by scale. You know, I'm looking for something here. And then suddenly there's something there. It's just so out of context with expectations. And I remember the first time that I went to Thunder Bay and came in and drove around. And even though I knew all about what these things did and what its ship size was relative to storage capacity, I hadn't related it. You know, my mind hadn't understood the scale of these facilities. And that, as I say, I can't remember the date or the time, but I remember the feeling. And then going in and the roar of the engines and the power, and then saying, okay, get on the Humphrey Limb, you know, get on, step on, and go up the belt, you know, and up there. So, I mean, it was an amazing time, and I many, many times back there since. But I do remember just being blown away with the massiveness of the, and I was, and the things you learn. I was just the other, out at the lake with some friends a few weeks ago, and we were talking about ice and boats and everything, and somebody was saying, oh, I've got this idea, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put a pipe out, and we're going to have some bubbles come up, and we're going to keep the ice back in the slip, you know, so the boat can... I said, so, what's new about that? I remember bubbles and the slip, keeping the slips open beside the terminals and bringing air up, bringing the warm air up with the bubbles by putting these bubble machines up the slips and getting an extra few days or whatever you did out of ice-free time on the slip. And these things keep, you know, sort of bouncing back.
Now, McCabe's elevator, I thought I knew which one it was, but maybe I'm incorrect. Is it in the stand near the Parrish and Heinbecker?
Yeah,
I think it was.
You know, it's so long since.
Besides Saskatchewan Pool 7, the big one.
You know, I couldn't be. Yeah. I'm afraid I couldn't be. But I seem to remember by the P&H.
Yeah, I think so. It was a... Yeah. Actually started out, I think, as a Government of Canada elevator, designed and at least supervised construction by CD Hub.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
yeah, and I'm sure that
I think
that seems right in my mind, but I can sit here and draw you a map of London and show every bridge and every square and everything for the whole of London north of the Thames, but I couldn't do it for Thunder Bay, I'm afraid.
What do you think your dad and in your shorter career? Let's start with your dad. What do you think he was most proud of in his career? Like, was there a particular achievement rather than sort of the general, obviously big achievement of taking that company and, you know, working from the ground up?
Well, there was an enormous, he was incredibly proud of Canada in sort of narrow ways, that he was able, you know, to do what he did here with the, with, you know, the opportunities, and proud of the country that did it and proud of the fact that he was able to do it. I mean, that was just a big thing. So anything else that he did was, you know, colored by that. And I've come to understand, you know, when he would go in the early years, most of the export business was built in Europe. But then they started shipping to Russia and to China, and he became a member of the board of directors of the Export Development Corporation, and he would travel to Japan and Hong Kong. And this business of being a Canadian and being reaching out in all these places and being there. And I know that was always going to London and having a place. I mean, I feel that. I mean, to me, London today is still like home. I established an office in London for my company afterwards. But when I go today, wherever I am, in India or South America or Singapore or Europe or wherever, and walk into a research lab and find our equipment there, that's a mind-blowing thing. And there's a scientist excited about showing what he or she is doing and what they're doing, and it's very significant at a personal level that, that it's your company doing that, but it's a powerful Canadian thing. And I know when I traveled with Mitchell, or when I traveled on my own, I'll tell you an interesting story that that really sticks in my mind. When I was in the Senate, three or four of us went to the Czech Republic, you know, and Dan Hayes, who was Speaker of the Senate, he was the official representative, and three of us went with him. And it would have been about 2003, I guess. I don't know if you probably wouldn't remember, but that summer there were terrible floods in the Czech Republic, historic floods. They were all the one in a thousand year things happened. Rivers peaked at the same time, and there was risk that Prague, some of the Prague, which had lasted through every war and everything else, might really be at great risk. And we were there just a couple of months afterwards, and Canada had provided some assistance, and so we were invited out to see part of what, how that assistance had been put to work and show some of the damage and the recovery. And we were taken to a headquarters outside of Prague. It was in an, actually a building in an oil refinery where the tanks had been floating around. Mm-hmm. And oil cars, tank cars, had been floating around. I mean, this is what, that's how bad it was. You'd look on a building and they date it. The last time the water had been that high was 1811. You know, that. So we were taken into a boardroom, and there was a PowerPoint presentation that was going to show us how they, their emergency team, how they organized to deal with this, because Canada had given, so we knew Canada had given some assistance. Screen comes on. What's the first picture on the screen? I live on Ash Street. The first picture in the scene is if I'd walked 5 miles down my street out onto the prairie where they built that last emergency dike in 97 that swung around to keep the river from coming in. That is the first picture. Manitoba, the floodway, everything. That's what they're showing us in Prague. Why? Because Chuck Saunderson and the guys from the Emergency Measures Group were the first call that went out from the Czech Republic when they needed help with this. And they went over and took charge of a certain section of the flood fight over there. Well, I mean, that's great stuff, you know. That is just terrific stuff. And I don't think Dad ever got over that any more than, you know, any more than I have. Specific things, I think the, I mentioned before, the canola, the creation of the canola crop was a, was really a transformative thing in the industry. The young people that he trained, you know, that ended up in all parts of the business, was another really proud thing.
Who were some of the people who were part of his team?
Well, his contemporaries, well, they're a bit older and a bit younger. The older team that he started trained under was a, and most of, there's really nobody around, a man by the name of Harold Thomas, a man by the name of Bert Frith, whose son Don Frith worked with me in McCabe. But the team, when I was working there, and the sort of legal secretarial, the corporate guy that I worked with was a man by the name of Scott Neal. Scott was a terrific guy. He had come as a lawyer out of Aikens McCauley when the company went public and went on. He was a president of the museum here and all sorts of things. Eddie Gould, I don't know if you've come across Eddie's name, but Eddie was the sort of VP sales marketing, and he had responsibility. Marketing included the terminal operation. So Eddie was the senior guy on the sales and marketing side of McCabe. And I think Eddie may still, yeah, I think Eddie's still around.
Out west, I understand.
Oh, is he?
Yes. I think with one of his children.
And, his daughter married one of Ken Powell's sons. He married to Ken Powell, and Ken Powell is another amazing guy and all this. Then functionally, the company was, my dad had a brother, Bill, who did the seed division, and there was a guy named Barney LeBeau, who was the great character who did the feed division. Then the younger guys, this is all relative terms, but the next sort of my contemporaries, the people were there. Fellow named Dave Champion, who went on to a terrific career in the industry with Richardson, with Pioneer. Tommy Chapman, who we had had an old connection with a company called Topfer in Germany, and he opened a Canadian operation for them and headed that. Ken Carswell, I think Ken's retired now, but he. After the sale, I lost track of where everybody went in the different companies because I wasn't around. But there was a whole bunch of human resources guy, Bob Johnson, who was just passed away actually last month, but went on to stayed with Cargill through the whole Cargill thing. But. I don't know. I guess it's hard to pick out. Just sort of doing it mm-hmm. is what the pride is. Just in doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's a big accomplishment, and there are so many things that contributed.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah, there's lots of pieces, yeah. But it.
Mm-hmm. Was he hands-on kind of guy? I asked that question because I talked to George Richardson yesterday, and I mean he was truly hands-on, right down to the welds in
ship bottoms. No. Yeah. Dad was very hands-on, and there was no part of the operation that he wasn't intimately engaged with. Because as an early, as a young guy, he knew Western Canada like nobody I ever knew. I mean, every town, every elevator point, every rail stop, everything. And I can remember as a little kid, we'd go out. In the fall, particularly toward the end of the summer, we'd be driving out in the country. And he would pull over and stop, go through the ditch, jump over the fence and into somebody's field and see how the crop was coming along. And I used to watch this, and, you know, when I was too little to, you know, he would say, I just want to see how the crop's doing. That was an answer for me. But then, and years later, in the summer, and I worked in the office, and I was... Part of my, I got moved around quite a bit. I'd go into the sample room, and all the buying and selling is against sample grain. And pop the door and open, here he would be, and looking at the oats or the barley or whatever, and checking it. So I mean, there was no gap. Nobody was telling him what that barley crop was looking like. He was taking it, and he had developed a particular. I meant. Barley comes to mind because he had developed a particular expertise in malting barley. So Duluth was another place that he knew well because the maltsters, the people who took the malting barley and made the malt that makes the beer. And so that was an area that he knew and was very, very hands-on about. Of course, you know, with the Richardsons, the range of their activities was so, you know, was so wide. But anyway.
My next question. I'm just on. Fortunately, a lot of the questions are already answered,
okay,
you know, through
okay.
what you say rather than my having to ask. But. I have a question here about what are the ingredients of a successful Canadian grain company? And I deliberately use the term Canadian because my sense is that Canada's a small country. I mean, it's big, mm-hmm. but population-wise, it's small. And a lot of the players on the international market are big population countries. So how did the little guy, and really many instances the new guy on the block, do so well?
Because we controlled the source.
Similar
to that. They had to come to us for the grain. You know, you could have Bungie, for instance, out of Belgium, or you could have Dreyfus out of France, or you could have whatever, but they didn't have the... In the end, they had to go to Australia or Argentina or Canada to get the quantities of the raw material that they could trade, and without something to trade. So that's what, you know, that's what we controlled. The seed and feed, seed processing business and the feed business was to meet our local market, and that's, there was really not much international about that. But in the end, there's not many places where the international trading giants could come for, they had to start somewhere, and they had to get the, and then the more specialized you get, right, you get to Durham wheat. So the Italians want their pasta, there's only one place they come, which is come to Canada for Durham wheat. And that's why. And that's what allowed, why we could sort of play above our weight, so to speak.
Questions about interconnectedness of the McCabe Company.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, a more general question than just, you know, sort of during your dad's time. Connection with the producers.
Well, I mean, personal, there were lots, you know. Dad knew farmers all the way across the country. And they were our customers, you know. I mean, we compete with service, and mainly with service to, because pricing, as the years went on, was less in our control. But in order to get a farmer with grain to deliver to come to your elevator and not to somebody else's, it meant having, you know, having relationships. But the so like in any business, you have to build those relationships and know people and
hire the right people.
Hire the right people, and
interface with
and
the
I
farm.
Know my what my father was, by his personality, was an extraordinarily approachable person. I mean, I never saw anybody walk into a room that was uncomfortable with him. And he walked through a plant or walked through an elevator, he was known by his first name. He was Charlie wherever he was, and that had a very easy relationship with the people. But and that was the main, well, that's one main point, connecting point with the producer is at the elevator door, you know, when they deliver. There's, of course, larger growers who would do hedging operations on the exchange, and as a trader, you get to know those people because they, and that's a different kind of a relationship. You don't see them so much in their overalls and Massey Ferguson cap, but there's somebody there who's taking a position on the exchange and wanting your advice on where to go, and those relationships were very, very good. And then on the processing side, on the feed and seed side, we built brands that were meaningful for the poultry producers, the cattle producers, that a branded product where you manufacture, take grain and add all the elements that you do to enhance it as an animal feed, and that's a manufacturing business, and those people that, you know, take you into very large industrial operations. In the end, there's no business is any different. I mean, the chemistry between connection between the customer and the the producer and whoever is customer and whoever is producer sometimes reverses itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of irreplaceable. And there's usually people who make that somewhere in the core. There's somebody that everybody identifies with. There's a personal chemistry there.
With the carriers, the connection of the company mm-hmm. with the rail carriers and the water?
Nothing special for McCabe. We were, they were a service provider, and I don't think I'd have anything. I don't think there's anything. Obviously, I mean, the knowledge of the the shipping, particularly on the water side. I mean, the freight markets, the cost of your, particularly on ocean freight. I'm thinking more than on lake shipping, but on ocean freight, that could, you know, where you're positioned on your freight availability on the bottoms, as you'd say, was usually very often the margin on a transaction. Because commodity trading is not a high margin business.
High bulk, but
high
not
bulk,
high margin.
Low margins, yeah. And so factors of foreign exchange and your cost of your freight were often the things that made the difference on whether you had a profitable transaction or not.
Connection with the Canadian Grain Commission.
They were the
connections and reaction to, let's say.
Well, I don't think of it ever as being problematic. I mean, I understood from my earliest days that that the thing that made our business successful was that when we went anywhere in the world, the fact that it was number one northern or whatever it was meant something. And that was going to mean something because the Canadian Grain Commission was doing its job. The maintenance of standards in the industry, is in any industry, is what you live by. And, wheat board's another matter.
Well, actually, they're next on the list.
I figured they might be. The wheat board was always, I mean, obviously, the major player in everybody's life, but for somebody who, and I guess there was always a sort of two or three different faces to the relationship, for somebody who grew up in the industry with basically open market, unrestricted trading markets and without a board or and the early years of death, there was no board at all, and then fewer grains. There's naturally going to be a dynamic tension between somebody who's controlling a market. And, I mean, you watch it today in New York, the battle between more or less regulation or whatever in financial markets. But here, once the board had their grains, and then the role of the grain company became very different. I mean, you started off by buying, everybody started off by buying at the same price because they established that price. And then, of course, going back to your earlier question, your positions on shipping and exchange and customer relationships and all these things become everything. Because if everybody's got the same starting price, then your variables are all these other factors. So, but the question of on the commission is clear. I mean, standards are, the entire success of the Canadian grain trade is built on the fact that there is never a doubt as to what a customer is getting when they're taking delivery of a Canadian product. And it is impossible to exaggerate or overestimate the importance of that.
I'm asking this question because sometimes things that were at one point and then become established as this is how things mm-hmm. are and then become myth in the long run because...
Well, you know, I don't know, and you've got, you know, you got to appreciate, I'm now looking, I haven't related to these things in a personal way in a very, very long time. So, but I don't, you know, I just don't see these as things where there were,
reality huge. Matched. The WEAP board is an interesting one because, like we, all of our company owners, we ask, you know, we ask these questions about the relationships, and we get quite varying answers. Some that are, you know, quite very strongly, the WEAP board, you know, shouldn't have been, shouldn't be, whatever. More of a reaction. Well, you know, see a place in it. Did your dad come down on one side or another? Like, did he?
It was a necessary evil. I would I would think is how he would. You know, it was there. I mean, he didn't go through his life saying, "Boy, maybe we'll get," you know, today the context today is different. I mean, the issues have been re-raised that were not. You know, there was a point in time where things were pretty settled fact, from the 30s through to the 60s. The political issues of today are much different than they were when he was active. And you know, my direct dealings with that, you know, I have to be careful because most of my thoughts or impressions of this would be things that I picked up in other contexts, you know, in Ottawa or in other ways, but not as an operator. And, you know, my career, such as it was in the grain business, didn't bring me into, you know, I would know the senior people because they were people who would be at the house or people who I would meet in some context, but I was never sort of hammering out issues with them or fighting with them. That just isn't anything that I could address. To me, they had their part of the market, and a lot of what we were doing was trying to find the commercial opportunities outside the ambit of the board. But in the export business, we were, you know, buying from the board, making our deals, and trying to find our customers.
You mentioned something earlier on about, well, what led to the Conviron setup. So the connection with researchers. Were there other situations where McCabe's was sort of involved, but not beyond the canola and the...
Not really, that I can think of. Not really. That was by far the principal one, and that was... you know, right toward the end of the, so there was never really, Conviron was quite a separate thing. It didn't really have any McCabe connection.
Mm-hmm. Relationship with the company with its competitors. Was it a?
I think there was a lot of respect. You know, I found it. You know, it's hard to measure these things, I guess, but you know, the people who headed the different companies, I mean, you know, George Sellers, Cy Leach, George Richardson, my father, and, you know, these were different. I don't put them all in the same lot because some of them, you know, were very different size companies. Mac Runciman at UGG. These were very close friends. I mean, these were people who really got along awfully well. I mean, they, you know, they battled out every day on the floor and around the world, but it was a very collegial, my impression growing up in it was that it was a very collegial group. And of course they had, whether Northwest Line Elevators and Grain Insurance and Guarantee and other things that were, had been developed, they were partners in these
industry-wide.
Yeah. So, and the industry did so much together, you know, negotiating with railways, do together, negotiating with government to a large thing. The private trade worked together. You know, I remember putting together one relationship that Northwest Line Elevators were sort of the spokesman for the private trade on a lot of issues. They were the Western elevator companies. And they were the ones who would get most frustrated about the co-ops and tax policy. That was the big thing. And I didn't think that they were always as sophisticated as they might have been in some of their arguments. So I arranged to get Izzy Asper, my good friend Izzy, who was then, what he was famous as is being one of the top tax lawyers in the country, and was to get him together with Cecil Lamont, who was the executive director, or whatever they called it, of the Northwest Line, to talk about trying to put a proper framework on the tax debate. And that led to them commissioning Izzy to do some columns, some articles on the subject, which began Izzy's career as the columnist for the Globe and Mail on tax, which went on for years until he went on to other things. But that sort of relates a bit to the policy thing before. There were some areas where the and as I got more involved in government and more involved in politics, I did feel from time to time that the trade weren't as skilled or weren't as sophisticated as they should have been in dealing in advocating their position. Co-ops were very good, you know, and the producer groups knew how to use their political clout very well, and the trade kept on getting painted into position of being these fat cats on the, you know, at the grain exchange. So that was always a bit, I mean, you know, the private trade is today is, you know, whether it's Cargill or Richardson's or the others are obviously in another world of sophistication on that thing. But there was a time there where, and it probably goes to your question, where they may have felt that the world was sort of ganging up on them, and why can't it be like the old days, and that. And I think there was a period. In my view, there was a period in the 50s and the 60s that was like that.
So my sense, which could be completely wrong, is that like there was the private mm-hmm. trade, so largely the family mm-hmm. companies. Then there was the pools, mm-hmm. and then there was UGG. So yeah. It was UGG.
UGG was sort of
straddling the.
UGG was sort of a hybrid between being. It was a producer-owned company, but it was and I'd have to actually go into their corporate structure to figure out. But it was always viewed that way. It was right. You're right. It was a hybrid between a private. Mm-hmm. It had a. Its own rules were different. I don't know if it operated on the co-op patronage dividend system or not. I really, you mm-hmm. know, it'll all have to do with how their financing worked and what.
So the friendship groups that you're talking about then, did it include the heads pools? Of the pools? Now Runciman you mentioned was
well, Runciman Mac was always. I always saw him as being more part of the private trade. Mm-hmm. But I shouldn't say that. Bill, anyway, who was head of the Manitoba pool, the guys who were head of the Manitoba pools were, just gone blank on it. But actually, in Manitoba anyway, the head of the Manitoba pool was always a close friend of, so somehow I'm ending up thinking that Saspool was always the toughest challenge, but I don't want to overstate that.
Well, and part of that could be that their head office was not.
Yeah, here. They weren't. They weren't in.
Yeah,
this, in
quite
this,
a small operation out of Winnipeg. So, okay, how are we doing for time there?
Yeah, how are you doing?
One hour 39.
Yeah, we've got about I'd say 5 to 10 minutes to. Let me just check my notes here and see what.
My voice is just about gone.
I know, I can tell.
I'm looking at my watch and my time is getting close. So.
Yeah.
But I don't want to cut you short.
No,
it's too much fun.
And I take a look at. Take a look at these questions, and again, I think you may say, "Well, you know, I think I've covered that. Significant events in the growth of the company, major achievements and setbacks. Anything to add to that?
No.
And I think like the sights, sounds, people, experiences, and stories you've peppered your.
I think I'm sort of.
Yeah. Now, take a couple of seconds to think about this one, because it says, the question is, are there any questions we should have asked that we haven't asked?
No, I always think of those about 10 minutes after you've left. I think we've covered a lot of ground, a lot more. I have to tell you, when you were coming, I was wondering what I was going to talk to you about for 10 minutes, let alone an hour and 39 minutes, but... I think we've covered an awful lot.
And I've asked, question
I'm
is...
sounding the way I am. It's going to be ridiculous.
Well, good thing we have that high-quality equipment.
Okay.
The other people we should interview, I've taken down a couple of names, like Don Frith, and I think Dave Champion's actually on my list already.
Dave would be a very good person to talk to, because he spanned really a critical area.
Do you know where... He's in Winnipeg, or
I haven't,
don't know?
I haven't seen him in...
Yeah, his name is on the list, so I think he probably is around a bit. Memorabilia, including pictures, that would be important in publicly commemorating the history of your family's contribution to the Canadian grain trade.
You know, it's a sad thing that I wish there was, you know, if I could say yes to this and that. I mean, there's all the sort of, well, the personal things, but you know, I don't think there really is.
What happened to all the files and stuff when the company was sold? Was there a Croft Archives or a McCain's Archives?
I have no idea. I mean, there were some, you know, there were from time to time articles done and things, but I wasn't around when the time of the when the company was, and I'm sure that things just got, people aren't very sentimental about that stuff. I try hard to keep my own stuff in order, and it's very, I'm always told, do you really need all those, as recently as this week, do you really need to take up all those shelves with all those boxes? Well, I want to get to them one day, you know. Anyway.
Good. Well, if anything ever comes to light somewhere, yes,
then
please let us know, because we're going to scan things in and, you know,
I will, and I'm always going through stuff, so I will. I'll be happy to call you.
Okay. Anything, B, that you can add?
No.
We've got a really good.
Well, I hope
picture.
I hope it's going to be of.
Thank you.
Of some use to you.